is the first time that we went and interviewed him and we were walking out the driveway, I looked at Chris and I'm like, that son of a bitch did it. And we'll get into it.
Yeah.
And you're going to know. But it was that feeling you get when you've talked to somebody and you're there and you see what you see and you talk to them and you're like, he did it, man. We just got to prove it.
Warning. The podcast you're about to listen to may contain graphic descriptions of violent assaults, murder, and adult language. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to the Murder Police Podcast, The Murder of Goldie Massey, Part 1. Welcome to the Murder Police Podcast. Today we're going to be discussing the murder of Goldie Massey, 2014. We have special guest with us today, Chris Schoonover, retired homicide detective, been with us on several episodes. Thank you for coming back.
Thanks for having me back. I enjoy it. Nice to see Dave again.
Yep. Yeah, good to see you too.
And we have also Steve McCowan, detective with Lexington Police Department currently. Thank you, Steve. We've never had you on here. We're so glad to have you. And so glad to talk about this case. It's a very interesting one.
Thanks for having me. Should be interesting.
Glad to have you. I mean, we've talked a long time about getting you in here, so a lot of good stuff to talk about on this case and how you came to be around, too. So.
And then we have my lovely husband here.
Yes, very lovely. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
So looking forward to it. So why don't you, Chris, real quick, kind of like we've done, maybe tell everybody a little bit about your background just to freshen them up.
Sure. I was in the United States Army. I was a criminal investigator special agent for CID. And when I got out of the military, I joined the Lexington Police Department and was in homicide for approximately 19 years. Retired in 2017 and have enjoyed my retirement. But these young detectives keep bringing me back and making me refresh my past life. So, and everybody should know Dave Lyons was my mentor when I first got hired and we were partners for a little bit. So it's always good to see him.
That's a polite word for it.
I've heard you're a good mentor.
Yeah, a polite word for it. And Steve, tell us, go in a little bit of detail. Start with how you got into policing and anything that led you to specifically to do homicide work.
Yeah, I'm a little bit interesting case for me. I went to graduate from East Kentucky University with a police administration degree, but I mean, I really didn't want to be a cop. I'm an outdoorsy type of person. So my whole goal was to sort of get into the fish and wildlife, be someone that was a fish and wildlife officer. But back in 1995, those guys weren't making any money. I mean, they were making like $16,000-$17,000. And, you know, I graduated and wanted to sort of start a career. But at the same time, my wife was in school to become a teacher with a friend, and her husband was working at the coroner's office in Fayette County. And we got to talking a little bit, and he's like, "Hey, you should come down and try it out. You know, see what it's all about." Me being from East Kentucky, I didn't know what the coroner's office was. So I mean, I was like, "Okay, give it a shot, see what it is." You know, so went down and talked to a few of the people at the coroner's office. And to me, it was intriguing. You know, it had a side of not really law enforcement, but a side of investigation that most people don't think about. And that's investigating death. And, you know, I applied, got hired there. I worked as an assistant where basically I was just going out and helping the deputies that were working at the time. I was just considered an assistant. So I would go out, go to scenes with them, you know, help them remove bodies, take the bodies to Frankfurt, you know, for autopsy and things of that nature. And then 4 or 5 months in, I got offered a position, started working as a deputy coroner, investigating, you know, all kinds of getting into all kinds of death investigations to include, you know, the coroner's office. They look into everything, any kind of death that happens in Fayette County. That's not a person that's not under hospice care or dies at a hospital under medical care, then the coroner's office looks into that. So anything ranging from homicides to suicides to, you know, car collisions where people die, suspicious deaths, everything like that is what we did. And I did that close to 10 years. And the part that was so helpful for me in understanding what I wanted to do with the rest of my career was getting to work with people like Dave and Chris. You know, the coroner's office, you don't really think about it in as far as investigation, but they are the proprietor of the body. So, I mean, there's the investigators from the legal side of it, like the criminal side, but then there's also the medical legal side of it, the coroner's office, who then has to take that body and make a determination of cause of manner of death. And that can be complicated in some ways because the coroner's office goes by different rules when you're talking about manners of death, you know, as opposed to when you're talking about a manner of death from the coroner's office standpoint, it can be different from the criminal standpoint. So I got to learn a lot. I got to meet a lot of people at the coroner's office, people like Greg Davis, who I know has been on here before, Emily Craig. I don't know if she's been on here, but she's world renowned.
And she's listening. We're coming.
And I absolutely, I mean, I could text her right now and I think she would text me back. I mean, she is just a phenomenal person, not just a phenomenal forensic, you know,
knowledgeable.
What was her title? She's a forensic anthropologist, but she was just an incredible person. And I could talk to her just like I'm talking to you guys, and she never made me feel, you know, inferior or anything like that. So what I took from my days at the coroner's office was a lot of learning, and in getting to work with especially the homicide unit and working murders and things of that nature, it sort of fueled in me that that's where I wanted to go. So worked at the coroner's office for maybe 10, right at 10 years, applied at the police department, got on, worked the road for 5 years, which was absolutely horrible. I hated it. I tried, but it wasn't where my heart was. You know what I mean? I wanted to investigate homicides because I knew in working with these guys and, you know, people like Rob and Dave Richardson and Franz Wolf and Matt Brotherton, all those guys, that's who I got to work with. And that's who I got to come up with in the coroner's office, James Curless, Paul Williams, all those guys, it's like they kind of wrapped their arms around me and, you know, because they knew that I was interested in investigation and they always involved me, in investigations, and it made me feel a part of it. And so therefore I wanted to be a part of that. So came to the police department in 2005, worked the road for about 5 years, worked third shift central, because I had kids and that's the only time that I could see them. And my heart wasn't in it. And finally got upstairs with these guys and I worked murders. I worked in the homicide unit for, right at 9 years, transferred out of the homicide unit in 2018. I'm currently in the intelligence unit and I do a lot of stuff with our NIB investigation with ATF. I'm in the process of, being a task force officer with them, and what we're really geared toward now. And for me, I didn't want to lose the investigative part of being a detective because I still enjoyed it. There was just things and dynamics that changed for me within the unit that I then left. When I left the homicide unit, I went down to intelligence and still being part of the investigations of NIB and gun crime and our violent criminals and our shooters within Lexington, I think is still important. And it's a part of me that still likes to investigate that stuff to be able to make a difference in, you know, in the community for me personally.
What's NIB for the listeners? What's the acronym and what's it stand for?
The acronym is the National Integrated Ballistics Information Network is what NIB stands for. Basically what NIB is, it is a fingerprint on a shell casing, right? So when you think of fingerprints, everyone has a unique fingerprint, right? And no one's fingerprint is the same. That is the same concept when you're talking about shell casings. Shell casings that eject from guns. So when a gun is fired, the breech face of the gun strikes the back of the shell casing and it makes a quote unquote fingerprint. And no two shell casings are the same. So we now have the technology that we can enter those shell casings into a into a system, and it's nationwide. We're split up in the United States into five regions, but we can do it nationally, and we can compare shell casings in California if we like, in Maine if we like, Texas, whatever. But we are on a regional, Midwest regional area where we focus on mostly Kentucky, Ohio, Illinois, Tennessee, Michigan. So we're on that region, and it's those shell casings are checked when we enter them. They're checked within that. It goes to the Correlation Center in Alabama. Pretty much what they do is they come up with, just like APHIS, they come up with the 10 best results that could be possibly a match. And then they have people that are actually looking at those, shell casings and making a match. And then we get the shell casings back, and it's not foolproof, obviously. I mean, it's not admissible in court. NIBIN isn't, but what we do with that is it's just a lead, just like in a fingerprint. We then take those shell casings to the lab to have a firearms expert look at it, and they can confirm that those shell casings actually do match.
Is that pretty successful?
Yeah, I think we're at like 99.6%. So it is very, if you get a lead, it's probably going to be what you're looking for, but we want to make sure, you know, by sending that to someone who is a firearms examiner expert to let them look at it, and then they'll give us a definite on whether or not, yes, you're looking at it. Ran into a couple of situations where guns have been released and then brought back and things of that nature that we have to confirm, but it's if you're getting an IBIN lead, you're getting what you need.
You think it's putting any kind of dent in violent gun crime at all?
Absolutely. And I would say for me personally, last year and the year before, I've been doing the NIBIN stuff. I took over for Bill Brislin, I think, who's done a podcast here with you all. He kind of started it, and then retired, and I took over for him to get this program going. And I think last year, we were able to adopt 37 or 38 people federally, on gun charges, and you know as well as I do, federal gun crime is much worse than state gun crime, because in the federal system, you're talking about 85% off the bat. There is no negotiation. They look at a formula. They figure out their past criminal history, and a person that gets caught with a gun and has a criminal history in the federal system is looking at a much more serious set of circumstances and probably time they're going to. And I think what that really resonates is within the community when they see, and I've talked to people and I know firsthand that word passes, word gets around within that circle that you don't want to get caught with a gun because the ATF's coming after you. You know what I mean? And when the ATF's coming after you or the DEA, or you're looking at some serious time. And once they know that, I think we've seen a drop in murders this year. And I'm not going to sit here and try to boast or anything, but I think it's because we have the people that were responsible for doing a lot of the shootings last year in custody. And I think you're seeing a direct result of that. And
that is the whole trick to violent crime. We won't go on a big soapbox today. There are so many people got really weird ideas on how to handle them, but I'm the first one. Incarceration is the fix. You just got to lock up the people that are going to commit it, and that's it. But good work. I mean, it's neat stuff to watch it have that much of an impact. And I think listening to you, what's neat too is your story, that you wanted this kind of work so bad that you put in your time. I mean, for example, there's a lot of people that believe, well, when I'm ready to be a police officer, I'll just transfer from Lowe's or something like that. And I don't mean to make fun of it, but I don't think they understand it. Minimum 30-week academy. On probation, for which it feels like an incredible weight. And like you said, you did your time on the road, because everybody starts on the road. And at our police department, by contract, you can't budge into something special without 3 years. And as much as I know you didn't like it, it probably helped you get rid of it.
Oh, there's no doubt. I mean, listen, I had my saving grace is I worked with really good people on the street. You know what I mean? I was in a squad and I had a sergeant that they knew what I wanted to do, and, you know, they took care of me in that aspect too. You know, I mean, there were many nights when I put handcuffs on somebody and I was like, holy shit, now what? Yeah, you know, I mean, exactly. Who do I call? What have I done here? But I had good partners. I had good sergeants. I had people that were surrounded. They knew that this wasn't my niche, but I was always going to be there for my B partners, for everybody that was in my squad. And it was a, you know, it was a return favor on their part. I mean, people like the Rick Rices of the world and the Jeff Jacksons and those guys, I mean, they took care of me and I'll be the first to admit, but everybody should work patrol. You need to learn how to talk to people. And I've said that from the beginning. People always ask me, how do you become a homicide detective? I said, if you can go to the mall and sit down beside somebody in the food court and have a conversation that's not about the weather or about, you know, something that's general, then you can do what we do. But you have to be able to talk to people, and that's a lost art, I think. And patrol gives you that opportunity to really get out there and talk to people, have an impact on people. And I think when people understand that you're just a human being like they are, they see that side, that human side of you, and then they'll actually, you know, want to give you information and, you know, they understand a little bit more what's going on with it. So
that's how you build rapport. And that's absolutely what it's all about. You got to be able to talk on stuff like that. So excellent stuff. It's neat to hear again how people come to this, and you probably helped a lot of people that are interested in getting this line of work to understand what it takes to get into it and to have that heart for it and keep pursuing it.
Well, thank you, Steve, for sharing that with us. That's really a very interesting aspect as to how you got into homicide from coroner. I can see it, but I you're the first person I've met who's done that. So thank you for sharing that. Well, this case, Goldie Massey, happened in October of 2014. Both of you guys worked it. Before we dig into it, why don't you tell me what really stood out to each of you on that?
I have two things that stood out to me. The more comic side was that I received the report, but I was in cold case at the time early on. Cold case just started, and this was the time frame. We got a federal grant. I'm trying to establish that cold case. So I get the report, and at the time, as we've talked before on this program, that the homicide unit, there's a rotation of who gets assigned homicides. By the time I get this report, Steve's originally the person next up on the homicide, but by the time anything happens, it goes through everybody in homicide, and then it comes
back to Steve.
Yeah. It was weird because when we first got the missing persons report, I was up for the next murder, right? And like Chris explained, we're on a rotation where it's kind of like a ladder. You catch a murder, you go to the bottom rung, and you just work your way up. By the time we were ready to charge the suspect in this case, I was back up. So we had went through the whole rotation, which was interesting about it. And so that aspect, I would definitely agree in that. And but don't steal my thunder on.
Oh, I won't. And the second thing that sticks out to me is usually during these type of situations when family's involved, you have family dynamics that there's always somebody in the family that has a vendetta against the victim, right? Well, there's twists and turns in this case that keep arising that we don't expect. So we have to follow those turns. And we know the end result, as we talked about before, is the end result is for the conviction. It's not for just the arrest of the suspect. So we are trying to think ahead of time, Steve and I, of, okay, we have to eliminate these people. We can't just say, okay, now we found a new suspect. We can't move on until we eliminate somebody else. So there's many twists in this case that we never expected. So I think that's what stands out for me the most.
Would that be the same for you, or do you have another standout?
A couple of things that really stood out to me, and Chris, I'm sure will agree when I say it, is the first time that we went and interviewed him, and we were walking out the driveway, I looked at Chris, and I'm like, that son of a bitch did it. And we'll get into it,
yeah.
And you're going to know, but it was that feeling you get when you've talked to somebody, and you're there, and you see what you see, and you talk to them, and you're like, he did it, man. We just got to prove it.
Hey, you know there's more to the story, so go download the next episode like the true crime fan that you are.
The Murder Police Podcast is hosted by Wendy and David Lyons and was created to honor the lives of crime victims, so their names are never forgotten. It is produced, recorded, and edited by David Lyons. The Murder Police Podcast can be found on your favorite Apple or Android podcast platform, as well as at murderpolicepodcast.com, where you will find show notes, transcripts, information about our presenters, and a link to the official Murder Police Podcast merch store, where you can purchase a huge variety of Murder Police Podcast swag. We are also on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube, which is closed caption for those that are hearing impaired. Just search for the Murder Police Podcast and you will find us. If you have enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe for more and give us 5 stars and a written review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your podcasts. Make sure you set your player to automatically download new episodes so you get the new ones as soon as they drop. And please tell your friends. Lock it down, Judy.